The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
From all appearances, really since December of 96, January of 97, they've been really focused on just the family. And what we're asking is that, you know, you've exhausted that viewpoint for the better part of 2 decades. And so, you know, what we're hoping is that we get them out of that fixed mindset and start to really look at the case for what it is.
That was investigator John San Augustine. Welcome to episode 4 of The Killing of JonBenet, The Final Suspects. I'm your host, Danielle Robay. In previous episodes, we learned how the initial investigation into JonBenet's murder was hampered by the inexperience of the Boulder Police Department.
From the moment that law enforcement arrived on scene on December 26th of 1996 to 755 15th Street, what we know is that almost immediately that crime scene was contaminated.
And also by a stubborn belief that the killer came from JonBenet's own family.
If you frame the case wrong from the beginning, if you have the media reinforce that 10,000 times over and over, if you have a police department that doesn't want to broaden an investigation when the case is not getting solved, if you have people they won't even talk to who are persons of interest in the case, and if you have a district attorney who intentionally decides to bury the indictment, what chance do you have of solving the case? Those are the right questions, in my opinion.
That is journalist Steven Singular. We have also learned that this belief was not shared by lead investigator Lou Smith, who, after devoting the final years of his life to the case, died in 2010 with a list of definitive suspects, one of which he believed to be JonBenet's murderer.
During the course of his investigation, as he's gathering facts, he's looking at the evidence obtained from the scene, evidence obtained at the autopsy, and interviews of witnesses during the course of the investigation, and he's comparing that to people who don't have a strong alibi but still have a potential connection to either the family or JonBenet. So, you know, when you start to piece all that evidence together, there are obviously some people that rise immediately up to a level where you go, we really need to look at these people, right?
But getting to the shortlist our team has in hand now didn't just happen overnight. Investigators who firmly believe that the intruder killed JonBenet have spent many years clearing some very compelling and very unusual suspects.
My name is Lori Simpson, and I'm from Florida. And I got interested in the case because my daughter's the same age as JonBenet Ramsey. And I just started watching it and following it, and eventually became friends with a gal named Ray Krogan, who actually worked with the Ramsey investigators, and she solicited me to help her at times, and I was vetted to help them as well. My first suspect was Santa Claus. Santa Claus was Bill McReynolds, and he was a professor, as was his wife, I believe. He was actually a professor for Chris Wolfe, I believe, who was another suspect. He was kind of odd in that he had a daughter who had been kidnapped like 23 years earlier, about the same day, at the same time, Christmas time, with a friend. It never was solved. the friend was violated, the daughter was not. And the wife wrote a play about a little girl who was murdered in her basement, so that was weird. But he had had heart surgery, and police said they ruled him out because he was would have been too weak to have done anything like that. But JonBenet had actually taken him down in the basement at their Christmas party days before and given him a little vial of fairy dust. And he said he kept that as special to him. So the whole thing about it was really strange.
As the suspects continued to surface in the early years, it became apparent that the sleepy little college town of Boulder also attracted a who's who of sexual predators. Here's Colorado News reporter Paula Woodward.
I interviewed Gary Oliva when he was in the Boulder County Jail. Gary Oliva was arrested. He had a child pornography background. He also had built a shrine to JonBenet Ramsey in his apartment that police discovered when he was arrested again on child pornography charges. When I interviewed him in the Boulder County Jail and we were talking and I said, well, tell me what you know about JonBenet Ramsey. And he said, well, I'll only do that if you give me a picture of her. And I said, nope, I'm out of here. And he went, wait, I'll talk to you anyway. And so he was a creepy guy. When he was rearrested, probably 3 or 4 years ago, someone who had been in touch with him said that he had confessed to killing JonBenet Ramsey. That has gone no further. His DNA does not match. Michael Helgoth lived in Boulder. He either killed himself or was killed on Valentine's Day, February 14th. It came just after a very forceful message from District Attorney Alex Hunter, who said, we'll find you. And then the next day, he's either dead or was murdered. It hasn't been ascertained, although it has been called a suicide. A friend thought he killed JonBenet, and that friend kept him as a suspect viable for quite some time.
There was a person who had committed suicide, and they were looking at that person because he had a stun gun. Apparently, when the sheriff's department investigated that, it was suicide. And then I guess it was after the fact that this person's name came up as a possible suspect, and that's when they started looking at him in retrospect. I think a lot of that evidence or information was gone at that point. But I know, like John said, I've seen Ollie Gray really looked at Helgoth.
Our team has tracked down a man who was a personal friend of Michael Helgoth at the time of JonBenet's murder.
What is your name, sir?
John Kennedy.
Let me start a simple one. Who was Michael Helgoth?
Michael Helgoth was an individual I met when he was about 10 years old at Valmont Auto Junkyard. And he was just a young, bright little kid, blonde hair, very clean, polite. And Mike became interested in the military after he got out of high school, went in the military, and then came out and then was working at the yard. From, say, April of 96 all the way through December, we were both working in the yard. Mike and I formed a friendship, and he wanted me to become a partner, and then we were going to together run the yard. I'm pretty sure he was into heroin. I know he dealt and sold weed, and he also was interested in cocaine a little. I'm sure he dabbled in everything at one point, either trying to sell it, make it, use it, whatever.
I love solving puzzles. That's what true crime is to me, after all, just one big puzzle. When I want to take a break from the dark stuff, though, I like to lighten up my puzzle time with Best Fiends. Best Fiends is a puzzle game where every level feels like uncovering a new layer in a story, one you get to take part in. I love that the game is challenging while not being frustrating. The best part for me is when I have to choose the fiends I want on my team for each level. I have to make sure I'm playing the best fiends possible based on their skill sets, and since every level is different, it requires me to choose wisely for every challenge. The more I play, the more fun it gets. Plus, you don't need the internet to play, so anytime I want a little entertainment, Best Fiends is my go-to. Best Fiends has thousands of levels already, with new levels, events, and characters added every month. It's hours of fun right at your fingertips, and you can even play online. With over 100 million downloads and tons of 5-star reviews, Best Fiends is a must-play. Download Best Fiends free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
John Kennedy explains how it soon became clear that Helgoth's problems were not restricted to abusing drugs. He also displayed some extremely disturbing behavior.
We had feral cats all over the place because we had thousands of cars out there. And he would feed the cats, and Mike would pick up the kittens and pick them up and throw them down on the ground and kill them. And if it was too wet out, he would pick them up and just rinse their neck. He had a homemade stun gun. He used to juice me with every once in a while. I go, cut it out. It just kind of make you go dzz. And he used to hit me with that every once in a while. I go, cut it out, Mike. Walking along, and he just says, I wonder what it'd be like to crack a human skull. And I looked at him, I thought for a second, I went, well, leave mine alone because I kind of like it the way it is, and I didn't want to know. It's kind of a strange thing. I didn't think much of it.
Even more disturbingly, Michael Helgoth displayed a sexual deviancy.
Mike was deviant, and his sexual preferences for girls and stuff was such that I talked to one of his old girlfriends, and she was blonde. And when she was 16, 17, this is prior to when I was at the ER, so it would have been 94. She told me that he made her shave all of her body hair off so she looked like she was a virgin. And he made her do all sorts of sexual different things. Then he had another girlfriend, the one where he was babysitting the girl's daughter, and she was a stripper at the bus stop, and I knew who she was, but I didn't know she had a daughter. Mike was dating her at the time, because I'd frequent the bus stop bar. And she came home and caught him naked underneath the sheets, is what the story was told to me by Lou and Ollie and everybody else. And he told her that he couldn't trust himself with her daughter.
John Kennedy also remembers one incident in particular that in hindsight seems extremely suspicious.
So then middle to late November, we're walking along and I'm on one side of the fence, he's on the other, and he's all smiling, he's happy. And I say, hey, Mike, what's going on? He says, I can't wait till Christmas. I said, what do you mean? He says, well, me and a partner are going to make 50 or, and he almost hesitated, or 60,000 each at Christmas. And I thought, man, I'm a cop's kid. I don't want to know this. Just shut up, John. Just don't want to get involved. So, okay, whatever. So that's why I asked him after Christmas about his killer deal, because he called it a killer deal.
Killer is one of the words.
That's what he said exactly. He said, I got a killer deal right at Christmas, and me and a partner are going to make, and he kind of has to. So I almost wanted to think if he was thinking about maybe saying 59 or not. I don't know. Later on, I found out that the ransom was 118,000. Half of that's 59. Kind of fits, you know, Christmas, broken head.
Detective John San Augustine explains why Helgoth was seen as a credible suspect.
I mean, when you look at Michael Helgoth, he's looked good from the very beginning just because of his history. I mean, you got a guy who was a paratrooper in the military. The rope that was used to strangle John Monet was paratrooping rope. He was involved in his girlfriend's little girl that, you know, there could be some pedophilia there associated with Helgoth, which when you look at the murder of John Monet, there's a lot of indications of some type of pedophilia. I think the thing that is most disturbing about Michael Helgoth, though, is the manner in which he dies.
In February 1997, Boulder County District Attorney Alex Hunter told a press conference that his department was close to a breakthrough on the case. Within hours, Helgoth was dead, apparently by suicide.
He ends up dead, and the timing of his death is very suspicious because it's February 13th or 14th of 1997. It was roughly within 24 hours of Alex Hunter coming out and telling the world, we know who you are. It's only a matter of time before we catch you, that Michael Helgoth ends up dead. And his death is very suspicious. He was shot somewhere in his lower torso. It was upward in nature from left to right, slightly upward in nature, and he ends up dead. Well, I can tell you, I've been to a lot of suicide deaths, and I've never seen anybody shoot themselves you know, down in their lower left torso. It's typically, you know, a gun to the, in their mouth, a gun to the side of their head. Very, very, very rarely do you see a shot maybe to their heart. But, I mean, it's down below his rib cage, and it's going upward in nature, about 45 degrees in as far as an angle, from left to right, forward to back. But strategically, what's interesting is that the prosecutors had traveled out to Quantico to meet with behavioral science experts to figure out a way to draw out the killers. And lo and behold, Alex Hunter comes out with this, you know, very matter-of-fact news conference, press conference. And within 24 hours, Michael Helgoth ends up dead. And, you know, I question whether or not it was truly a suicide. The gun was wrapped in a blanket. You know, none of this stuff really makes any sense. It was actually found on the left side of him. You know, he's right-handed. The gun was from left to right. Just the nature of the crime scene, you know, gave indication that we should at least look further into it.
I believe Cindy said that Lou referred to him as Boot Man.
That's correct.
Why would Lou Smith have referred to him as Boot Man?
Because during the time that his alleged suicide happens, at the base of the door, he's lying on a futon, and at the base of the door is a pair of high-tech boots. Those boots were subsequently taken and given to Boulder PD. The high-tech boot is significant because there is a high-tech boot footwear impression that is found where JonBenet's body was found, you know, that morning that her dad goes downstairs and opens that door to see JonBenet there.
Also significant was the fact he had a stun gun.
Exactly. So the other thing that was noticed at the scene where the alleged suicide of Michael Helgoth occurs is that there is a stun gun, of which that stun gun, the diameter of the probes on that particular stun gun, it was, I believe, an air taser. That air taser matches the injuries to both JonBenet's right side of her face as well as to her back, of which those injuries are more consistent with a stun gun mark as opposed to what's been professed about burn marks. In fact, how I know that is that Dr. Doberson, in fact, who is a forensic pathologist, conducted a test involving a pig and stun gunning the pig, and those injuries appeared on the pig as well as consistently with what we see on JonBenet Ramsey's front of her right face and on her back.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
John Kennedy, the personal friend of Michael Helgoth, doesn't believe Michael Helgoth killed himself either.
Yeah, Mike had a girlfriend named Carol who had Mike on the phone that night that he died. in February of 97 on the 14th. They had a conversation around 7 or so, and she's dead, but I did get a confirmation from some people that know her that she said she had a conversation with Mike and it was normal. Everything was fine. Wasn't arguing. Everything was just normal.
And as he tells our team, he thinks he knows who might have been responsible for killing Helgoth and why.
Who is John Stephen Giga?
He was my neighbor, and I knew Steve had been in the prison because he told me he learned how to do hardwood restoration in prison. I thought, well, that's good to know. Not that I care about what his problem was, but then I found out that he had taken a babysitter and raped her.
But Gygax and Helgoth were tight.
They became tight real quick. So much so that Mike was at his wedding. John, Stephen Gygax, and Michael Lennon Helgoth both said to me two different times each, independently, by myself with them, that they both wanted to commit a perfect crime. And I thought, that sounds kind of strange coming from two different people at two different time frames.
I've talked to even his aunt said they don't believe that it was a suicide. They do believe he was murdered. And John St. Augustine, who worked for the Ramsey family, did a story on that and showed how he could pretty much prove that it was, he believed it was a murder, not a suicide, and had to do with what hand was used and where it was placed and all this. But I believe that he was probably, he could have been killed by John Stephen Gygax, because I spoke to his wife and she said that he was very much into drug dealing. This is well known because there's many arrests for that. And there's been situations where apparently the rumor was that they were dealing drugs in and out of the auto salvage yard that they both worked at. So Gygax was mad. I think he may have killed Michael Helgoth, but it had nothing to do with JonBenet Ramsey. I believe that it had to do with a drug deal. I think maybe he was stepping on his drug business. There is reason to believe that was the case. And I don't want to really elaborate on that, but there were drugs found in his apartment after the police left and they missed them, according to our sources.
But he was an interesting, or I don't know if they ever really got his DNA because he was dead, but he was an interesting suspect because of the boots and when he died. I think that's what made him so interesting.
Yeah, there was apparently a stun gun next to him and the boots, and I don't think it was released to the public about the boots being high-tech boots at the time, but I've heard that almost everybody in the Boulder area wore high-tech boots back then. You know, it's a hiking area, so that could be easily a coincidence. But yeah, he was an interesting suspect.
Another strong suspect was photographer Randy Simons.
This is Pamela Jane Griffin. I met Patsy and JonBenet at JonBenet's very first pageant that she ever did. Randy Simons did the most beautiful photography. He had a knack for catching just the right angle on a person or a child, and he helped all models get their portfolios together. So we went through Christine's whole thousands of pictures. I mean, when they were little and he was doing headshots, he would flirt with them and say, oh, those are some pretty eyes. Boy, you might have to get my son to marry you. And then the little girls would giggle and he'd get that shot, you know.
Stephen and Joy Singular, authors of Presumed Guilty, an investigation into the JonBenet Ramsey case, the media, and the culture of pornography, also looked closely at Simons.
We were, as Joy said, began talking with pageant mothers in the area who had been in on the child beauty pageant circuit with Patsy and JonBenet. And we heard a couple of things. One was that they had to get rid of certain people because they felt they were attracting, you know, child pedophiles or people who could engage in that activity. So it was on the edges of that. We were told that Jaminet's primary personal and professional photographer was a man named Randy Simon. And Randy had been shooting her picture for a couple of years, and all of the beauty pageant mothers that we spoke with said the same, exactly the same thing to us, that since the murder, Randy had been calling them up in the middle of the night, after midnight, you know, hysterical, screaming and crying, saying, "I did not kill Jaminet. I did not kill Jaminet." And they were all totally mystified because no one was looking at him as a suspect, and they had never seen him behave this way before. And they just sort of began telling us this same story, which we found very curious.
Randy Simons was questioned by detectives investigating the case, but was ruled out. But as recently as last July, he hit the headlines again when he was arrested at his home in Oak Ridge, Oregon, and charged with 15 counts of downloading child pornography. Does this new development once again put him in the frame of the murder of Jaminet? Here's Detective John San Augustin.
Let's just take a guy who's in prison right now.
Mm-hmm.
Randy Simons.
Mm-hmm.
He was a photographer. He took pictures of Jaminet. I mean, who was Randy Simons? Do you know too much about him?
I know a little bit. I know that he was a photographer. I know he had some close association with the family. There was a lot of tension drawn to him because, you know, he was potentially a suspect in this.
I believe his DNA was taken and it didn't match.
Right.
So I think we would say, well, that's it for Randy Simons.
Negative. That's not the way you look at an investigation. And you know, when you investigate a murder, and I've been involved in a bunch, you know, I don't know, probably, you know, a few hundred death investigations under my belt. One of the things that you have to be extremely careful of is not to put all of your weight in a specific aspect of the case. In this case, you know, don't believe that because DNA doesn't match, that there's no way that person can be involved. Just like if the DNA does match, you can't say that, you know, you're absolutely 100% positive that that person was involved. All you can say is that that DNA was found in an area that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So now you've got to look at that individual and see if there's other aspects of the investigation that also points to this individual. So getting back to your question about Randy Simon, he's incarcerated, a DNA sample has been obtained from him. It's been compared to the DNA in Jaminet Ramsey's, and it doesn't match. You have to be very careful about saying, because the DNA doesn't match Randy, that Randy's not involved. The reason why I say that is there's an indication in the crime scene that there were multiple people in the scene. You have two definite footwear impressions that are different. Unless the guy was wearing two different pairs of shoes, we can say that there's a likelihood that there were two people at a minimum inside of this home. Well, one may have been the person who was sexually assaulting and ultimately kills Jaminet, but the other person may have just been, you know, on the lookout. It's no different than a, you know, an armed robbery of a bank where, you know, a teller gets killed and somebody's on the lookout to see if law enforcement's coming to that bank. Same thing was going on potentially here. There's evidence to indicate that there might have been more than one person involved. So just because Randy Simon, his DNA does not match, we don't know who Randy Simon was associated with and hanging out with in the time frame of December 25th, 26th of 96. If we can show that he's in that area and we can show that he had an affiliation or, you know, somebody that he was aligned with that ends up matching the DNA, well, that would be no different than the armed robbery case of the bank. He would still be charged with conspiracy to commit first-degree murder.
Was Randy Simons an accomplice to someone on Lou Smith's final list? Doug Longini and Jameson have new leads to follow. Next time on The Killing of Jaminet, The Final Suspects.
We were in the hospital room with him, and he just said that he wanted this case to continue. He wanted to keep looking, you know, just keep looking. And he gave us a name. He said, "I want you to write down this name and start there."
The Killing of Jaminet, The Final Suspects is hosted by me, Danielle Robay. Executive produced by Dylan Howard and Matt Sprouse, and is a production of Broad and Water Studios and Endeavor Audio. Executive producers also include Tom Freestone, Doug Longini, Susan Bennett, James Robertson, and Andy Tillett. The series is written by Dominic Utten, reporting by Doug Montero. The series is mixed and engineered by Sean Kravitz and Sam Ada. There is so much more to this story, and you don't want to miss anything, I can assure you. Subscribe to The Killing of JonBenet, The Final Suspects, wherever you get podcasts. If you have information that could help our investigators and the Ramseys identify JonBenet's killer, please email us at tips@justiceforjohnbenet.com.